Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Friday, the 16th of August. Coming up on the program, disaffected doctors throw down the NHI gauntlet. The fight between Booking.com and the Competition Commission is seemingly over. Are we dealing sufficiently with the impact of climate change on food security? And how to get the hermit consumer off the couch and into the mall? And we start with this: following Business Unity South Africa's decision to boycott the 2024 Presidential Health Compact signing, thousands of doctors and other healthcare practitioners are rejecting the entire document. The compact sees the National Health Insurance Scheme underpin the entire strategy, which stakeholders are rejecting. Joining me first up on the show is Dr. Simon Strauchan, South African Health Professionals Collaboration spokesperson. Dr. Strauchan, welcome to you. Why are you rejecting this?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Correct. This is a large amount of doctors. And importantly, the collaboration is widely representative of both the public and the private healthcare sector. So we participated in the 2013 and 2019 health summits, which is a really good platform for open engagement, well-structured, highlighting the important pillars or elements of a health system that needed to be considered in terms of trying to develop a more equitable and integrated unified health system. The NHI never formed a significant part of any of those discussions. Remember, back in those days, the NHI was still a bill, and there was already quite a lot of complaint and concern and objection to the bill at that stage. So for the health compact that has been presented to us, for us to ratify and put a signature to, it really doesn't accurately reflect the discussions that took place in those health summits. Now, the content of it, in terms of the explanation of the various elements of a health system, the understanding that there is inequality, the understanding there's need for access and universal health access, all of that is very well represented within the document. But the fact that the NHI has been placed at the very center of this health reform, that was not part of the discussions. And for those reasons, we're saying it doesn't reflect what we're participating in. People already know the concerns that we have, not just as a collaboration, but as individual entities of the collaboration. And that's why we're not signing it.
Help me understand, is the rejection of this based on procedure, or is it simply you ratifying your objection to NHI?
Well, let me put it this way. If the health compact was presented to us with the same wording that it had and removed any significant reflection or any significant position of the NHI within it, which is what the health summit was about, if it was presented like that, we would have no issue with it. We agree 100% with the steps that are needed to be taken in this country to improve the infrastructural system, to improve the health personnel in the public sector, to better govern the private sector, to control pricing in the private sector. That's all contained within the documents, within the writings of that compact. So remove the NHI overarching implementation necessity from that document, and we would have no problem with it.
It's early days at this point, but what sort of response have you had so far from government, if any?
No, we've had no response from government at this point.
Are you expecting something?
Probably not. I mean, if we have to be honest and look over the last 4 or 5 years, with all of the participation that we've had, I mean, the fact that the collaboration made a submission to the president in December last year, just after the National Council of Provinces approved the bill, we who made a submission to the president and saying, please apply your mind. Please look at the bill in terms of its constitutional elements. We really believe that there are problems here and that this is going to be challenged in court. And we never even had a response to that,
The reason why I ask you that question, is there a concern now that your organization or your collaboration is simply going to be sidelined and the caravan moves on?
Well, unfortunately, if you don't want to be sidelined, then you just have to be louder. Mm. So already there's two members within the collaboration who are preparing court papers, and that will be lodged within the next couple of weeks. So that's the way, you know, if we have to be heard, we're going to be heard that way. If we're on court at the table to sit down, if there can't be meaningful discussion about the concerns, well, then we're going to have it argued out in a court of law at great expense to everybody else, and possibly dragging out this process for, who knows, months, years. We'll have to wait and see where that goes. So that's the one way to do it. You know, if you want to get into it, let's get into it. The other way is that we are not going to be silenced. We are going to continue to make ourselves available and to make every platform that we have aware and avail ourselves of the opportunities to say we are here. We really are here to make sure that healthcare professionals will participate in this process. We want to be part of the solution. We want to ensure that the patients that we serve will indeed end up with good quality access to healthcare. But we just do not believe that the NHI Act as it is at the moment is the vehicle that's going to deliver that. So those are the two really important points. And it's a dividing line that I think that we need to be very clear about. We talk about the NHI Act as the vehicle to achieve health reform in this country. And then we look at the realities of what is needed. And we're going to engineer and to eventually attain really good quality healthcare in this country that people have access to. You don't actually need that kind of NHI Act that carries a big stick with it, where people feel threatened, where people are feeling threatened by it. So let's sit down, let's discuss, let's negotiate. And if we're not called to the table, well, we're just going to keep knocking on that door until somebody opens it.
So what do you put on the table in terms of allowance for an equitable health reform process without relying solely on NHI?
It comes down to looking at the current health system and the budget that is already available to that health system and asking the question, are we at the moment running the most efficient health system that we can in this country? Is the money being apportioned correctly? Is it being accounted for? Is it being used in the correct spaces, in the correct fiscal period? And I'm using those words because we know we've heard recently in the media around budgets that have not been spent, budgets that have been misaligned. We need to look and say, has the National Department of Health looked at any other options other than the NHI Act as it currently stands? So we need to look at what we currently have. We need to look at the health professions we currently have. And we need to sit down and go, what is it that the country actually needs? And we know that even in the definition of universal health coverage from the WHO, it talks from the ground up. You need to have the right infrastructure. You need to have the right geographic representation of that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You need to have the infrastructure that is well stocked, well resourced. And then you need to have the right set of personnel. So if we cannot create an atmosphere, if we cannot create the scenario in this country where healthcare professionals are willing to go and work in far-flung distant places because life is okay there, we're never going to get there. So it comes back to the fundamentals of what a health system is and what the social determinants of health are. You need to have the roads, you need to have the water system, you need to have the power, you need to have the infrastructure, you need to have that. That's what we need to be looking at. And I think that there needs to be serious discussion around the current budgets and how effectively those budgets are being used. Sure, we can look at ways to enhance that. And there have been many submissions made on other mechanisms around low-cost benefit options, around gap cover, around using RAF funds, rather than saying we're going to tax people, we're going to make it harder, again, there have been many media statements made by groups saying that if we're going to follow the current NHI Act, it is just unaffordable. And within that, the Act is containing elements around quality of care, and we're very concerned that we're not going to end up with quality care. So go back to the basics, look at what we've got, make sure we're using it correctly, get people around the table who participate in this day in and day out, public and private. Get good public-private partnerships. You know, the private sector is willing, open arms, to say, come and contract with us. Identify the services that are not well covered geographically. Identify the services that are unaffordable. Even if it's basic primary healthcare screening, come to the private sector and contract with us, rather than coming with a bill. And we can only make decisions and comments on the facts that we have. To hear somebody say, oh, but it's going to be rolled out like this and it's going to look like that and we didn't really mean that. Well, you can't use rules and regulations. You can't promulgate those to explain an act. We can only make decisions on the act as we have it. And the act as we have it, we feel, is not viable.
And I am going to leave it there. Dr. Simon Strachan, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Booking.com, the largest online travel agent in South Africa, has agreed to scrap rules over pricing as part of a settlement with the Competition Commission. Under the new agreement, Booking.com will no longer be able to prevent accommodation providers from offering lower prices on their own or via other booking platforms. More now from James Hodge, Chief Economist at the Competition Commission. And firstly, how did the entire issue of price parity first come to the Commission's attention?
So this arose in a market inquiry we did into online digital platforms. So it covered a range of platforms, but really about platforms that do business to consumer sales. So they allow accommodation providers, in this case, to get direct bookings from consumers. And this is an issue that had arisen in Europe and was partly solved there, but they continue to impose a restriction in South Africa. But we've also now got a more complete solution, as you noted, that in Europe, it's still not required that, or not prevented, that they can ask accommodation providers to price the same on their own channel versus booking.com. We've now succeeded in getting that scrapped too.
What informed your decision, and in what way was competition threatened or challenged?
So these have been strongly linked to competition problems. And just to take an example of one of the biggest South African platforms, Lekkerslaap, this would mean that an accommodation provider could not price lower on Lekkerslaap versus booking.com. And what that does is restrict price competition between the two, because in effect, the accommodation provider pays a commission fee to these platforms. And Lekkerslaap could say, look, if you give me a lower price, I'll charge you a lower commission fee, and let's drive the sales through my platform. So it effectively drives a lot of competition for commission fees. And booking.com, if they know that you can't price lower anywhere else, there's no reason to necessarily drop their commission fee. So it has been important to develop alternative channels, South African channels, in order to compete with what is a global company.
Well, Booking.com is a huge organization, as we know. How much pushback did you get from it?
Well, look, in an inquiry, we gather a lot of evidence to demonstrate the effects, and it always helps to have some international precedent around this. But Booking.com initially sought to appeal our ruling in the High Court and at the Competition Tribunal. But I think ultimately the strength of the case and the strength of the evidence, this was something that was going to be settled and resolved, and so it was.
James, can you tell me then how the settlement is in the very immediate term going to benefit both the provider of the establishment itself and Jeremy Maggs, who's looking to go on holiday?
Well, very much so. And one of the aspects we found that was problematic with one of the price parity clauses is that you could not price through your own online channel for your accommodation at a lower price than on booking.com. And what that meant for a lot of accommodation providers, they want to develop their own channel. They don't want to be paying commission fee on every booking that they get. And you'll know probably, Jeremy, there's some accommodation providers that says, well, look, if you come back next time and book direct, I'll give you 10% off. So there can be very direct benefits to developing that direct channel, both for you as a consumer, but also for the accommodation provider, because there's not an intermediary taking a commission fee.
So do you think that we're going to see a lot of differential in pricing strategies among accommodation providers right now? And I'm wondering if that has already started.
I certainly think so, because at the public hearings for this issue, we had big players such as Sun International. We also had smaller players who've come and said, look, we do want to experiment with differential pricing. And the one aspect that we're interested in, for instance, is that Booking.com also brings in international tourists. And they're on a different budget, and we may want to distinguish. And so developing their own channels or local channels through local platforms like Lekkerslot become a way to do that. And they felt that this price parity clause was restricting that ability for them to innovate, differentiate. Mm. So, you know, there will be many that just stick with the same price and don't worry about it. But I think some of the more innovative ones that are trying to get a more growth will certainly look to price differentiating.
And James, are there potential hurdles or challenges in monitoring Booking.com's compliance with these new terms?
Well, ultimately, this is about the accommodation providers, because by announcing this, we've said to accommodation providers that Booking.com cannot force you now to price the same as on their own channel. And so an accommodation provider does get a restriction from Booking.com, they can come to us and say, we are facing this restriction. So often these are seen as almost self-monitoring provisions, because those affected have an interest in ensuring that they are enforced.
And if those rules or that agreement is transgressed, what happens then?
Well, then we would have recourse to take them to court for non-compliance. But in a context where you've announced it to all the South African accommodation providers, it would be surprising that they would try to then enforce it. You've got more than 25,000, I think, South African accommodation providers on their list.
James Hodge, I'm going to leave it there, because as we have this conversation, I'm feeling a long weekend in the Eastern Free State coming, so I have work to do. I appreciate your time. James Hodge is the Chief Economist at the Competition Commission. James, always good talking to you, and thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
In July this year, the United Nations released its annual report on the state of food and nutrition security in the world, and it highlighted the fact that Africa is by far the region with the largest percentage of the population facing hunger. By 2030, 53% of the global population will face hunger, and they will be concentrated on this continent. I want to explore now the nexus of food security and climate. Vuyusile Moyo is a postdoctoral research fellow, African Climate and Development Initiative at UCT. And firstly, how does climate variability and extreme weather specifically contribute then to the worsening hunger crisis in Africa, as I've outlined?
Okay, yeah. So what is happening and what I've seen is because of the El Nino effect, the climate is really changing. The seasons themselves are changing. We are seeing extreme temperatures coming up now and low rainfall, and sometimes the rainfall is more than anticipated, leading things like floods and droughts and all. So I think this climate variability, it has started causing like hunger problems, especially in the global south, where you find that most of the people depend on rain-fed agriculture. And if we have this rain, which is not constant, and we have these extreme temperatures where people do not even know what kind of crops to grow, when to grow them, and the lack of early warning systems, because most of these events come when people are unaware. And by so doing, sometimes when their eyes open, the farming season is already gone. Like, for example, this past season, find out that most people are still waiting that maybe the season will be normal. But before they knew it, the season was gone, which is why you see that in countries now like Zimbabwe, South Africa, Zambia, now we are actually starting to request for aid. Like, for example, for maize, which is the staple food in the global south, from as far as Mexico, as far as Russia, and all those countries. So it shows that this climate variability is seriously affecting most communities.
Do you think governments are awake to the problem, and do they have the right policies in place?
It depends. I think the policies, they're in place, but what the challenge now is on the implementation of those policies. Because some of them, like, for example, now we'll find out that in the NDCs, people be having like good policies of saying, okay, we'll have early warning systems in place, this is what we'll have in time and all. But the implementation now, of course, the implementation I think also can be affected by the lack of resources. Like, for example, in terms of reach to some of the remote communities, you find out that most of those people, they do not have like network reception, number one, where they can be told that in the next week there will be heavy rains, prepare yourselves, or these past 2 weeks there will be a heat wave and things like that, prepare yourselves accordingly and all that. So I think, yeah, policies are there, but the implementation part is the problem.
And in that respect, is it a capacity issue in terms of implementation, or is it a lack of money and resource?
It's a bit of both. Can be a lack of capacity in the sense that right now, in terms of the priorities, you see that, for example, right now people will be saying, okay, we cannot be focusing on this when there are pressing issues and all. But above all, I think it's also about misplaced priorities. Or see that sometimes money can be there, a budget can be allocated to that, but how it's used now. You'll see that most of the money then end up going to the management and all instead of going and doing the groundwork. So yeah, it can be a bit of both.
All right. So what then is the trajectory, in your opinion, if the status quo remains, if we don't act quicker and become better at implementation?
The trajectory is we are actually heading for disaster, where very soon we'll be countries that will be relying on aid. Yet we have the land, we have the resources to do all the things. All we need is to just sit down and say, okay, these are the resources, we channel them into right places. Like, for example, we capacitate the communal farmers, because I remember from my PhD study, I saw that most of the food security is actually secured by the communal farmers themselves. So if you capacitate the communal farmers by making sure that they have access to care, so they've got access to inputs, they've got access to all this information, and also being capacitated in terms of knowledge, in terms of given resources, like for example in some areas, irrigation facilities might work. We also try to infuse climate smart agriculture together in those knowledge systems. I'm sure if we do that, we can do better, but if we give a blind eye, we are actually heading for disaster.
All right. Well, talking about a blind eye, do you think that South Africa's response is sufficient?
I think they're in the right path. They're in the right path. Of course, it hasn't really gotten there where we'd like it to be, but I think it's in the right path, from my own opinion.
All right. Vuyosile Moyo, thank you very much indeed for joining me from the University of Cape Town.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program today, retail sales, says trends analyst and futurist Dion Chang from Flux Trends, estimated to represent around 20% of South Africa's GDP. Chang believes what he terms seamless service and user experiences, considered design and high-value shopping experiences, can really draw customers from what is termed the hermit state. And Dion joins me on the program now. And first up then, what do we mean by a hermit consumer, and how is the behavior of this person evolved post-COVID?
Okay, so the hermit consumer, I picked up an article in The Economist actually at the end of last year. So they coined the phrase, and I was really interested because people have been saying for a long time, we haven't really quite seen the full effect of the pandemic, and the hermit consumer was one of those kind of trend confirmations, as we call it. And they reckon that it's a $600 billion global shift. So it's everywhere. And even in a South African context, even though we don't have that sort of maturity in the sort of online space, you're seeing a huge uptick in people being very, very at ease with ordering whatever online. And so you know, we're catching up. So what the hermit consumer means for me is that it's not just what the buying patterns of that consumer are, but what the ripple effect is going to be on logistics, delivery, and specifically service.
But it's beyond that as well. I'm imagining that these people who are effectively sitting at home on their couch in front of their laptops or their phones ordering stuff, is it influencing the types of product that they purchase?
Yes, so I think the sort of convenience stuff, or the things that you get irritated by, like grocery shopping and stuff, you just do that online. But also that hermit consumer is showing that change of what people are starting to buy. So you're buying stuff that is going to make your cocoon even more comfortable. So you're insulating stuff. If it's summer, it's kind of outdoor stuff, maybe a bra, you know, those kind of leisure activities, but more centered during the home, which means, you know, that retailers or hospitality businesses have to work even harder to make sure that when you do emerge from that cocoon, that you are going to have that fantastic experience to keep people motivated to get out.
Dion, you're not making a value judgment here. You're just pointing it out, I assume. But what you're also saying is that physical stores, the bricks and mortar, need to work harder. So how do they draw the consumer, out from under the duvet?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are quite a few influences at play here because, you know, don't forget we've also had an impact of a really, you know, bad economy, and that's global. So times are tough, disposable income's not always there. So to get people out there, I think before the pandemic, people were concentrating on, the buzzwords were experiential marketing or getting that experience. But it was kind of more sort of entertainment. I think post-pandemic and kind of the hard realities of less disposable income, you are looking at a customer who is going to shop around, but when they want to buy something, it's got to be of value, it's got to be a good service. And that means whether it's online or offline, that customer service means you need to go over and above just selling an object or product. So it's not just transactional, it has to be a lot more deeper than just a transactional process.
And what does that mean when you say it's got to be deeper, that experiential importance and the seamless service and going beyond? What do people, particularly behind counters, need to do now that they have not been doing in the past?
I think it is that going one step further. If you think about the disconnect between, in many cases, an online experience and a bricks and mortar experience for the same brand, I think that's the big challenge, is that you've got to make sure that it's echoed in both, because your customer is not going to make that differentiation as like, oh, I'm online and then I'm going to the store. I mean, obviously they are in a physical sense, but in terms of a kind of brand loyalty, you want to make sure that echoes in both realms, so that you have that great experience. You are motivated to keep your loyalty there, to keep spending your money there, and you saying, they're thinking more than just the bottom line. They're thinking about me as a customer, and I value that. And people are valuing that more and more.
And that is what is meant by dwell time. In other words, you want me to go to the shopping mall, and I need to hang about a lot longer, not just visiting and leaving quickly.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, visual merchandising is sort of really, really integral and pivotal in terms of that. Just looking at one of the stores in the V&A, instead of one of the things that they were saying is that instead of putting those impulse buys at the till and sort of cluttering up the till, they've laid out a whole table of smalls, and it shows that people are spending more time there, looking at things, making stories, visual stories within the store, little vignettes, all of those kind of things, so you want to be excited, you want to discover things, you want to turn a corner and you find something that you didn't expect there. And then if that is all sort of enveloped with really, really good caring and authentic customer service, you're going to feel really, really good about spending your money, your hard-earned cash, and you're going to come back.
And then the holy grail, of course, is integrating the physical and the virtual. And there's a word for it, which I'm going to try and pronounce, phygital.
Yes, I'm not quite fond of that word.
It's a horrible word.
But yes, so phygital is the thing. But I think if I put my trends hat on and my futures hat on, go one step further, the beyond phygital is actually what we're seeing, and already sort of big e-commerce markets like China have perfected it. It is social commerce. So that's selling via social media platforms, but they have invented the playbook. And in fact, a lot of big American companies are asking China to kind of export or come and train them at boot camps to do the social social commerce, and it's live social streaming and wanting you to buy things. So depending on your age, I remember telesales, and you switch the TV on there, but now it's just going to be in your face and on your screen, and it's really hard sell, limited offers, and you just buy through social media platforms like TikTok or Instagram. Mm-hmm. But TikTok's kind of the king of that platform.
It's very, very exhausting. Dion Chang, thank you very much indeed. And that also informs our online poll today, the way we shop. Are you a hermit consumer? Are you a hybrid? Or are you a strictly bricks and mortar person? If you have a view on that, please participate in the poll either via our X or LinkedIn pages. On our last poll, government and business talking up cooperation, I gave you three options. One was, are you confident? And there was a split in opinion between a lot of hot air and let's see what happens. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. Have a good weekend and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.